Welcome to the weekly podcast from the Church of England. With a minute's silence being held for the victims of the Tunisian shootings, I speak to a Sussex archdeacon about two people from the diocese who were killed and who will be remembered during the national event. As the church commissioners disinvest from the company SoCo, we hear why they made the decision. And as things hot up at the Wimbledon Tennis Championships, I'll be finding out what a local church does to get involved in the event. But first this week, as the first of the 29 British victims of the Tunisian shootings are repatriated, churches and cathedrals around the country have been holding vigils and are preparing to mark a nationwide minute of silence at midday on Friday. In the Diocese of Chichester, Crawley Town Hall will be the focus for the silence as they prepare to remember two people from the diocese who were killed in the massacre. Fiona Windsor is the Archdeacon of Horsham and she'll be there.
We'll all be congregating at the Town Hall and hopefully many people will come. So people will gather and we'll have a minute silence, and there's also going to be a book of remembrance there as well.
I understand that one of your bishops as well has been expressing his sorrow this week.
Yes, Bishop Martin Warner has expressed his horror and shock at this terrible act of terrorism and the profound loss, and also about the remarkable stories of fortitude, generosity and compassion as well that bring good out of awfulness.
What will you be thinking about during the minute's silence?
I'll be thinking of the family and friends of those people who have lost their lives, particularly of John and Janet Stocker, who are the two people from Crawley who have been murdered, and for their family. It's so awful just to have your family go on an ordinary holiday, which so many hundreds of people do all the time, and then to receive their bodies back in coffins because they've been shot on a beach. It's all so unthinkable, and yet it's happened. So my thoughts will be with their families particularly and their friends.
Now, you know the people of Crawley and you know what they're like. How do you think they will respond to rally round the families of those people who have been killed?
I think they will do that brilliantly and with great care and compassion. And I think, well, I hope that that will bring them strength and encouragement and the courage that they will need to face the next few days, weeks, months, and how they will continue to live.
And the Church of England has released prayers for the minute's silence, which can be found on the front page of the website, www.churchofengland.org, and look for the In the News section. It's been announced this week that the church commissioners have disinvested from SoCo International because of concerns about the company. The commissioners had £1.6 million invested. I spoke to Adam Matthews, who's secretary of the Ethical Investment Advisory Group for the Church of England, and asked him his reaction to the news.
Well, this is a very important decision by the church commissioners, and it's a decision that's not been taken lightly. The church has only made very specific divestments from individual companies over the past 5 years. It's only been done twice before. So this is the third time that such a decision has been taken. And it's taken after a very detailed assessment of the concerns that we've raised, the company's response, and then really a judgment about whether the company has responded to the depth and with the sincerity that we've sought. And in this instance, the company was found failing in that, and a recommendation was made. And I'm obviously pleased that the commissioners acted very promptly to divest their holding and also to agree to put the company on the restricted list to prevent any future investments as well.
What were your concerns about SoCo?
They ranged from specific allegations that had been made by a number of international and local NGOs in the Democratic Republic of Congo about allegations very much about human rights abuses, corruption, bribery associated with the activities of the company in the area, in the national park in Virunga. Additionally, there was very considerable concerns about the intentions of the company in relation to the park itself and the sort of determination potentially to have the boundaries of the park redrawn. And it's a national, it's a World Heritage Site, and it has very sort of particular sort of environmental value, etc. And there was concerns about what the company's intentions were for that. And then we had sort of concerns in relation to the governance of the company, independence on the board, and the need to ensure that so the views of minority shareholders are really strongly represented, and that there was a proper address for the concerns that we were raising, and that the company had policies that were really in terms of human rights, corruption, etc., and that these policies were being adopted and properly implemented.
So how much work actually went in from your side to try to address the concerns that you had with the company?
Well, as soon as we these were brought to our attention, we began communicating with the company, initially at staff level, and then it got elevated very quickly to a very heavy, intensive engagement with the chairman of the company and also the senior independent directors on the board of the company. We met a number of times with them, both individually as church investors represented by the EIAG, but also as a group of concerned shareholders with other major investors as well. We very clearly relayed the criteria that we and the areas that we expected the company to respond, that we wanted to see a very credible, transparent and independent inquiry undertaken by the company. We want to see the scope of that inquiry and the results of that inquiry put in the public domain. Likewise, in terms of seeking statements from the company in relation to their intentions for the park boundaries, we wanted to see that again explicit in the public domain. And so we raised these concerns in individual meetings through communications, and then most recently last month at the annual general meeting in London, where we made a very specific request that the board consider the position of the chairman, as we felt that it was not responded, the chairman and the board was not responding to the concerns of shareholders sufficiently.
It must be a really fine line, though, because obviously when you divest, you've then got no input at all in anything that's going on. Just sort of, can you explain a little bit more about, you know, whether it's when you decide you actually have to walk away and it's better to walk away?
Well, it's a very, you're right, it's a very difficult judgment to make, and that's why it's a decision that's very carefully assessed in terms of the criteria that we use to go into an engagement such as this. And that's also a reflection of the fact that we've not divested from any companies individually, as I say, to others in the last 5 years, because you do actually see many companies move through engagement. Engagement often is a very positive way of ensuring that concerns that are being brought are actually addressed by companies, and many companies respond very positively to that. Our concern, though, is that when the level of seriousness of these allegations, there needed to be a real sincerity in the company's response, and we really took a judgment that it was not responding to the depth that we were expecting, particularly when you had allegations of human rights abuses, etc., where you needed the transparency and credibility of an independent inquiry to be able to actually ensure that they're properly addressed. And divestment is the final sort of act, obviously, of your engagement. But at the same time, there's a point at which you have to make a judgment. Is your engagement actually getting the company to a position that you would be comfortable with, or really can you continue to maintain your investments and derive profit from that company going forward? Is that sort of ethically acceptable? And in this instance, it reached a point where we felt that wasn't possible. Our hope, obviously, is that the company will still take the steps that we've outlined to them, that they know what they are, and we know some other investors that we still are in communication with are raising those points with them.
Adam has written a blog about the divestment, which is on the front page of the Church of England website. Prince William and the Duchess of Cambridge's daughter, Princess Charlotte, will be christened on Sunday. The Archbishop of Canterbury will conduct the baptism at the Queen's Sandringham Estate in Norfolk. Every week, the Church of England has over 2,200 christenings, attended by an estimated 250,000 people. The Reverend Kate Botley, who is part of the Church of England's baptism project, explained why baptism is still so popular.
Because people are still having children and want to bring them to God and ask God to bless them. What I'm seeing in my churches is the number of christenings we're doing is going up and up and up year on year, and that's really exciting.
What reasons do people tell you when they come, particularly if they're not churchgoers?
Yeah, well, they're desperately serious. That's what's really interesting to me is, you know, I think sometimes we can be quite dismissive in the church of people bringing their children for christening, presuming that it's just for the party or just for the presents. But that's not the case at all. When I talk to mums and dads about why they're bringing their babies, it's because they're deeply serious about giving their child the best start in life. They don't always have the right language, if you like, or the church language to talk about christening in terms of, but they do want something that they can't quite articulate. They're looking for God's blessing, they're looking for protection, and they're looking for the best start possible in the Christian faith.
Now, one of the things that comes out of the Church of England research is that godparents are really important to people. What's your experience of that?
Absolutely. Godparents, I find, are a really important reason why people are bringing their children for christening. And quite often, by the time they've come to talk to me to kind of get the date sorted and the ceremony sorted, actually they've already chosen the godparents. In fact, some of them are choosing godparents even before they have the children, because they want to tie in those key important people into their child's life. They're saying, you are the people that have supported us, and we want you to carry on supporting us. In fact, this weekend I had my first request from a lovely young couple who've just given birth to a baby. He's 7 weeks old. He's getting christened next week. And they said, when I said, who have you chosen to be godparents? They said, we'd like all our family and our friends to be godparents. So we're looking at bigger numbers as well of godparents. People are choosing, you know, not just maybe one or two people, but much bigger numbers of people as well to be godparents. I'm not quite sure how we're going to work that one. I think we'll probably go for nominated godparents up at the front.
I was going to ask you about your experience of baptism, yeah, because it must be one of the really lovely aspects of your job.
It's an amazing aspect, and you do, you know, sometimes vicars are very busy people. I look after three churches on 3 days a week, and I love what I do, and sometimes you forget yourself, and so you kind of pile into a church service, you think, oh right, I've got christening now, and you sort of focus, and then you hold this baby at the front and you think, oh my goodness, you're entrusting me and entrusting the church family with the most precious gift that God's given you, your child. And it's such a privilege, and the joy is just infectious. And I love doing christenings. It's one of my best parts of my job. And people, I'm so glad that people are still bringing their children to be baptised in our churches. That's just so exciting.
The research also showed that tradition was really important, yeah, to people as well.
Yeah, what's really interesting is when I talk to families, what they want is they want tradition. They definitely want some sort of tradition. We see that from things like people using the same christening gown as perhaps the parents have been christened in, or the mum or the dad or whatever, you know, the family christening gown. We see a lot of that, and we see intergenerational photos, so, you know, three generations gathered around the font, all that sort of stuff. But as well as wanting traditional, there's also an element of we want it to be relevant, and we want it to be enjoyable, and we want it to be fun. So the vicar has quite a tricky path to tread, actually, at times, of being, you know, tradition and prop things being proper, but also adding that element of, you know, this is also relevant, this is also friendly and warm, and all those sorts of things as well.
What do you think about before you do a baptism?
I pray a lot that pray for practicalities, that I won't drop the baby. That's always a worry for me, because I'm very short, and so trying to get the child over the font is just a practicality of that is quite tricky. I quite often get the mum or the dad, if they're taller than me, to hold their baby, and we sort of do it together. And so that is practicalities, really. But also, there's that wonderful man. I mean, I'm a mum myself, and, you know, I remember my children's pregnancies and births. And there's just this amazing moment when you first hold your child, regardless of how you be feeling. You know, and not everyone falls in love with their baby at first sight, that's known. But there is a sense when you have a child, or when you meet a young child, that there is something bigger than you, this sense of, oh, this is a miracle, but it happens every minute of every day. And that's just wonderful. So it's just a sense of enormous gratitude, enormous blessing is the thing that goes through my head.
The Reverend Kate Botley. Finally this week, with the Wimbledon Tennis Championships in full swing, a local church is getting involved by renting out car parking spaces. The money St Mary's raises from the venture is split between several charities. Marianne Turnbull from the church is the parking organiser.
We do have this quite large field adjacent to our churchyard where it is possible to park a couple of hundred cars. And so we started parking cars very early on. I think it's been going for 25 years for parking.
Now, that sounds like a great idea in principle, but it must be an awful lot of work.
It is a lot of work, but it is fantastic. The congregation just really enjoys doing it. It brings us all together. You meet people that you wouldn't otherwise meet. You meet members of the outside world that you don't always meet, and have some lovely conversations. And in the early days, we used to also run a picnic stall, and so there were probably a couple of hundred people in the church involved in the whole tennis operation.
Now, unfortunately, I would assume this means that you're all so busy parking that you don't actually get to see any of the play.
You do get to see the play because most of the volunteers work in shifts. So nobody does more than 6 hours on the car park throughout the fortnight. And if you can't spare 6 hours, there's plenty of other time in the day to watch the tennis.
Now, explain to me how it works in practice then. How many people do you need, and what do they have to do to sustain the operation?
We use about 15 volunteers a day. We open at 9 o'clock, and obviously for the first few hours while we're parking the cars, we have a lot of people on duty, and it's quite frenetic. Later on in the day, we also monitor the regular users of the church who also need access. So there's a bit of double parking and making sure that other people, facilities in the church have normal. We close at 10 o'clock, which is about half an hour to leave after the last match. But the roof has rather changed matters, because if the roof is closed, play can go on until 11 p.m. And so sometimes we don't get rid of our last car until 11:45.
As well as meeting members of the public, presumably it's a good fundraiser for the church as well.
Well, we park 150 cars about every day, and we charge £25 per car. And so it is a fundraiser for the charities. We spread it between ourselves and these other charities that are nominated by members of the congregation. One is always very local, one is national, and one is an international charity.
Who are you raising money for this year?
This year we're raising money for our local deaf school who want to set up a family centre. We are raising, then the national charity is the Dan Maskell Tennis Trust, who's trying to promote tennis for disabled people. And our international charity this year is Operation Noah.
Now, we're talking on what is the hottest day of the year, so I can't even imagine what it must have been like for you in a field this morning. But what do you get out of it when you go home at night? What are those days when, you know, it's been a really good day?
Well, obviously the fundraising is fantastic. I just love meeting people and being part of a community volunteering scheme that has been going a long time. It's very, very satisfying.
And you can find out more about Mary Ann's role as she tweets from the RC of E Twitter account next week. That's it for this week's podcast. I'm Gillian Moody. Thanks for listening.